Why Care? The first talk in a series entitled Biblical Philosophy was presented by Jack Crabtree on January 3, 2006 at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2006. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved.
Let me just give you a little bit of an orientation to what we're going to do, both the content and the format. In terms of the content, what I want to do is have a series of conversations with you about what I'm calling biblical philosophy. And what I mean by biblical philosophy is not a philosophy of what the Bible is, although we will touch on that. But what I mean is an understanding of the worldview and the philosophy of life that is taught in the Bible. Now, hopefully this would go without saying, but I think I better say it anyway. I need to say it anyway. Like everybody in this room, and like everybody else in the world, whether they admit it or not, I'm in process. I reserve the right to change my mind tomorrow about what I tell you tonight. This is the biblical philosophy of life as I best understand it today. And I continue to learn, and I continue to grow in my understanding, and I continue to study. So this is not the last word, and I'm not pretending that this is the last word. But that's the best shot that I can give at articulating what I think the Bible says as I understand it today. I'm going to be handing out a series of notes. The purpose of the notes is to be a conversation starter. I'm not going to lecture, per se. I may do a lot of talking. I just depends on how it works out. But I'm not really lecturing. I'm not preparing lectures. I'm just preparing the notes, and then I'm going to use the notes as a place for you and I to dialogue about this. Now, I realize there's a lot of us, but what I'm hoping is that this will be a free-flowing conversation between me, you, and you with one another to a certain extent. The only ground rules I'm asking is remember that you're not the only one in the room. So, you know, please be sensitive to the fact that if you and I get involved in a two-way conversation, be sensitive to the fact that it needs to be contributing to the understanding of everybody so that we don't get so narrow and esoteric in what we're talking about that it's not of profit to everybody. And therefore share the space as well. So as long as you're sensitive to the fact that there are more involved than you and me, I hope you'll feel free to ask whatever question, share whatever insight that you want to. Okay. So the way we'll do this is that I'll just start looking at the notes and commenting on the notes, and then just feel free to interject. I guess we should have some ground rules. You know, maybe raise your hand or something and let me acknowledge you, so that I can finish my thought before you interject. But beyond that, this will be a free-flowing discussion. I've broken the notes up into chunks. The nature of the free-flowing discussion is such that we're just going to talk until our time's up. And I may finish a section, I may not finish a section. I'm just going to note where we left off, and next week we'll come back and take off from there. So we're just going to leisurely make our way through these ideas that I've tried to outline in the notes here. Okay, I want to start by just asking the question, why care even about biblical philosophy? Why is this worth our time to look at? And as I put here as my main point, biblical philosophy and only biblical philosophy, at least by its own self-assessment, only biblical philosophy captures the truth about how a human being can find true ultimate fulfillment. A little later, I'll address the question, how do we know that it's true? How do we know that it's claimed, that it's the only philosophy that does that, that captures the truth? How can we know that? I'll reserve that till later. But that's what it claims. The Bible claims that this is the way to life. But the way I'm phrasing it in this point here is that it captures the truth about how a human being can find true ultimate fulfillment. In my assessment, Aristotle in his Nicomachean Ethics, he begins that by saying the one thing that all the philosophers agree upon is that, and he uses the Greek word eudaimonia, that the whole point of our existence is eudaimonia. It's usually translated happiness. Happiness is a relatively unhappy translation of the word eudaimonia, I think, because the term eudaimonia, I think, is much more a much more subtle concept than our concept of happiness. A lot of us, as we grow older, recognize the importance of trading happiness for substance in our existence. We'd rather have a substantive, meaningful, fulfilling existence, if you will, even if that means not being happy, than being happy at the cost of living a shallow, superficial, meaningless life. I mean, if you want happiness, there's all kinds of drugs that'll do the trick on the short term. But happiness is not the whole, is not the point. The point is that our existence be meaningful, deep, profound, substantive. And something like that, I would argue, is what Aristotle has in mind when he says we can all agree that the point of human existence is eudaimonia. The Bible doesn't use that word. It doesn't use the term eudaimonia. But I think the concept is implicit in what the Bible is saying. Instead, the Bible goes one step further and makes a proposal for what eudaimonia for a human being actually is. What is it that human beings need, ultimately long for and desire and want for their existence? Well, the proposal is that they want life. A fairly ordinary and mundane term. But what we want is life. Now, the Bible uses several different terms for it. To translate them, it would be, well, one of them is not very translatable. I would translate it ionic life. That is, life that pertains to the age is what that would mean in Greek. Or life in the age of ages, or life in the last age, or life in the final age. Sometimes it just uses the word life itself without any further description. But the concept, I think, is consistent throughout the New Testament writers. What Jesus came into the world to offer was life, life in the age of ages. And the concept is coming from the Greek understanding of the world, that you could meaningfully divide cosmic history up into these things that they call ages. You have existence going on in a particular way, and then there's some significant break with that age, and you enter a new age where life is qualitatively different than it was in the age before. And then you enter a new age and a new age. And so basically the understanding of history was that history is this progress from age to age to age throughout the whole cycle of history. Using that kind of picture, using that kind of model for history, the biblical authors recognize that there's a final age. There's a time where existence is going to undergo a final qualitative change, and then we will finally come to that targeted age in history that God ultimately had in mind from the very beginning. We were not made to live in this age. We were made for the final age. That's why this age can never really satisfy us. I think that's the message of the book of Ecclesiastes. Breath, breath, all is nothing but breath. Or vanity, vanity, all is vanity. Emptiness, emptiness, all is emptiness. That when we look at the stuff of this life, compared to the longing and the desire of our heart, this existence simply doesn't give us anything of substance. It disappears on us. It disappoints. It's not as meaningful as we hoped it would be. Death robs us of anything important. The stuff that seems important ends up through experience to not be important, really, to not be fulfilling. So this world ultimately cannot satisfy us. And from a biblical perspective, there's a reason for that, because it wasn't meant to satisfy us. It wasn't created by God to be that sort of thing. Rather, in the purposes of God, this age was created to be a kind of training ground, a school, a classroom, a stepping stone to that which finally would satisfy us. And that which would satisfy us is life in the age of ages. When death is done away with, when evil is done away with, when futility is done away with, all the stuff that makes this existence bittersweet rather than sweet, it's all going to be changed, transformed. It'll be qualitatively different. And life in the age of ages will satisfy us in a way that life in the present age could never possibly satisfy us. So that's the vision of the Bible. And so what the Bible is doing, I think, is answering the question that is implicit in Aristotle's ethics, and that is, we can all agree that human beings want eudaimonia, but what brings eudaimonia? And the biblical answer is life. The thing I like about the biblical answer, unlike Aristotle's answer, for example, where Aristotle's answer is what will satisfy the human being is rational comprehension, grasping rationally that which can be rationally grasped. Well, I think that's part of it. I mean, I don't think he's altogether wrong, but the problem is it's so one-dimensional. Human beings are so much more than just rational thinkers. That's a big, huge part of what we are, but it's not all that we are. And so the Bible's answer is not reductionistic in the same way. It doesn't reduce us to minds. It recognizes that our humanity is a complex existence, and that what's going to happen in the age of ages is that the complexity of this existence will be preserved, if not even multiplied, and in the complexity of that existence that we will have, we are going to have a multifaceted existence that will somehow reward us in all the ways that we expect our existence to reward us, and not be robbed of its meaning by any of those things that rob this existence of its meaning: death, evil, and futility. So, all that's to say, why should we care about biblical philosophy? Because if the Bible is right, if it's telling us the truth, then it is the document that gives us the only truth about how you and I can ultimately find this ultimate fulfillment that it proposes we were made for, that it suggests was our the reason we were created in the beginning. Let me look at my notes here. Belief in certain key components of biblical philosophy is an essential prerequisite to attaining life in the last age, the ultimate fulfillment of a human being. Now, one of the things you learn rather quickly as you read through the Bible is who are the people who are going to get this life that brings ultimate eudaimonia? Who are those people? Well, they're the people who believe. The people who don't dismiss what the Bible has to say about that, but who actually embrace it as true and believe it. But that needs to be qualified. It's not actual explicit belief, I don't believe, that marks us as people who are going to be rewarded with this life in the final age, but rather it's an inward openness to the truth of those beliefs. That's the necessary prerequisite to life. I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that I made for so many years as a Christian, is that, and it was reinforced, I think, by the Christian culture around me, is that we in modern Christianity have a tendency to see explicit belief as the thing that marks the believer as the believer. If you don't confess Jesus as your Lord, then you can't be saved. And sometimes we get really, really dogmatic about that. I really don't think that's the Bible's perspective. It's not the explicit confession that Jesus is my Lord, but rather it's the inward openness to bow the knee to Jesus when I'm confronted with the truth of who he is. But there are people in the world, either through some kind of ignorance or other historical accidents that aren't really confronted with that truth. I mean, if you just look at it historically, who does Paul in Romans hold up to be the father of your and my faith? Abraham. And yet Abraham never confessed Jesus as Lord, because it wasn't even a possibility for him. He wasn't confronted by that truth. He didn't have to acknowledge that truth. But he's the father of your and my faith because the heart of Abraham was to hear the teaching of God, the promises of God, and be open to them and believe them. Well, that's what we're being called upon to do, is to be open to the truth about who God is and what in fact he's up to and what in fact he's promised. And if we have that kind of openness, then that marks us as a different, an odd sort of human being in this world. Because your typical human being is closed to God, hates God, is hostile to God, and is not frankly interested in his promises. So when we find ourselves open to that, it's because something is marking us off as different. And what's that difference mean? That we have been set aside for life, to be rewarded this life in the age to come.
How then, if it's not an actual explicit belief, and yet only biblical philosophy can lead to ultimate fulfillment, how can one not have the same inner openness to the truth of the beliefs without it being explicitly the Bible? Or can someone have that inner openness if they're of a different religion? Without knowing the Bible?
I should think that in principle it's probably possible that someone in a different religion is open to the reality of God and the truth about God. They just don't know much about it because they're growing up in and being nurtured in a religious tradition that isn't telling them the whole truth, or is telling them a very confused version of the truth in some way. So I think that in principle it's possible. Is it in fact happening? I suspect so, but I don't really have any direct evidence of that.
So then what do you mean by biblical philosophy, and only biblical philosophy captures the truth about how human beings?
Okay, because what the Bible is doing is it's describing the truth about who God is, what he's up to, what his purposes are, what he in fact has promised to mankind, and how he's done that, and so on. It's telling us the truth about all those things. And it's telling us the truth about what we must do about it. You know, what kind of response should we make about to that? But what I'm arguing is one of the things that true record tells us is that it's not my act of believing it that makes me a child of God. It's something else that makes me a child of God that is typically and normally going to manifest itself in believing this truth. That's true. That's the typical mark of my being a child of God. But it's not an essential mark. It's not the only thing God can use. You see what I'm saying? So, yes, it tells us the truth about who God is and what he's doing, but it's not an explicit act of believing that truth in particular that makes me a believer or makes me a child of God. So that's probably radically different than what most people in Christian culture are accustomed to, the way they're accustomed to thinking of it, because they're accustomed to thinking of it that if you don't make an overt, explicit act of confessing Jesus as Lord, then there's no way in the world that you can be saved. I mean, that's just a given. But, you know, what do you do with Abraham then? And I mean, really, Abraham, the historical evidence would suggest he was a heathen. I mean, he didn't start off a Jew. He was a pagan moon worshiper, probably. And God appears to him and begins to reveal his purposes and his plans and draws him out of his culture to another land and progressively over time educates him about who he is. But even Abraham, it's interesting in the discussion of Moses had with God on Mount Sinai, it wasn't the first encounter, but one of the later encounters, there's a very, very revealing statement where God says to Abraham, your fathers knew me as El Shaddai, but you will know me as Yahweh. He's basically giving himself a new name. And it's not at all clear. I mean, this is certainly debatable, but in my judgment, the significance in the shift of names is that El Shaddai was probably a name that was appropriate for a polytheist who believes there are multiple gods, but who worships the one supreme God over the pantheon of gods. That he's the God Most High. And that Abraham came over time to believe of the God of Abraham as the God Most High. But it appears that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, all of them, died before they ever came to realize who it was that they're dealing with. They were dealing with Yahweh, which translated means he who is the way I would translate it. That's controversial too. But he who is, I think, which I think is referring to the utter transcendent nature of God. That God is he who is just in and of himself, the one who has existence in and of himself, and who transcends this existence, this contingent existence that didn't have to be, is nothing compared to he who is, who just is in and of himself, and whose existence is not contingent in any way on anyone or anything. I think that's what Yahweh is trying to capture, that name. And Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob did not know that they were dealing with he who is. They thought they were dealing with El Shaddai, the Most High God. So even there, you could argue that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are not really even Jews yet when they die, and yet God is bringing them along, training them, teaching them, guiding them toward the truth. So if he could do it to them, in principle, could he not do that for other people and other religions in the world today? I don't know why not. Is he doing that? Well, I don't know. That's not my call, but in principle, I see no reason why he couldn't. Yeah.
And one thing that might be helpful, but I am not sure you said it clearly, is that you would believe that they would eventually...
Absolutely.
If not in this life, but in the Day of Judgment, the last life, that they would believe the book of philosophy.
Right. They'd have to.
And I don't think that was...
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it's because this is the truth, I'm going to get to this is the objective truth. I mean, that one of the most important things that we need to come to terms with in our culture today is that when the Bible describes itself as the truth, it doesn't mean truth with a small t. It doesn't mean the truth such that as long as you believe it, it's important in your life. The biblical truth is such that if you stop believing, it's not going to go away. It still describes reality. You still have to deal with the God that the Bible is describing. You still have to deal with the purpose of history that is described as being the purpose of history as the Bible describes it. It's not going to go away just because I choose not to believe it. That's truth with a capital T. That's the objectivity of the truth, or the objective nature of the truth of the Bible, is that it's not true just because I credit it as being true. It doesn't need me to credit it as being true. It still describes the way reality is going to go. And that's why the Bible can describe me as being a fool if I don't come to terms with it, because it's the way it's going to go down. And since it's the way it's going to go down, I need to take seriously what it says, what it teaches, and deal with it. And one of the ways that we will come to terms with it is that everyone who's a child of God will eventually, when all the pieces are put in place and all the knowledge that they need comes to the fore, will voluntarily and gladly bow their knee to Jesus. If they won't, in the end, voluntarily and gladly bow their knee to Jesus, then they ain't no child of God. So, yeah, we're right to insist on the truth and the centrality of Jesus and his lordship as part of our faith. That's true. But do I have to know that and know that now in order to be someone that God is calling out and bringing to himself? And that's what I'm arguing. I don't think so, because Abraham didn't know it now when he was reckoned righteousness.
Yeah,
righteous by God.
So you're not saying that, sir, you are saying that biblical philosophy is the truth and Buddhism, Islam is not also true, and you also get to God through them. You're just saying those people, though they may be Islamic, Buddhist, they still have a heart, a true heart for God, and one day once confronted with Christ, They will go.
Right. But again, we can be too dismissive of other religions because once you begin to know enough about other religions, there is some truth to the fact that they share a lot of elements with Christianity because a lot of them are based just on observation of human life and experience, and intelligent people have observed human life and got some things right. And so I think you can find a lot of things in other religions that both overlap with what the Bible teaches, and if they don't overlap, are nonetheless true. But you're certainly not getting a clear presentation of the big picture in those other religions, because their overarching story that they tell is not the same as the biblical story.
But a lot of them don't explicitly come out and say worship Christ. But some of them do explicitly deny Christ. And
that's wrong. Yeah, that's terribly wrong. But a test case for the kind of thing I'm talking about, though, would be Orthodox Judaism. It does seem to me entirely possible that you could have an Orthodox Jew today who would vehemently deny Christ and be a child of God. Today. They'll be bowing their knee to Jesus later. But today they deny him. Why? Because you won't find a more deep-seated prejudice in the world than the prejudice of Jews against Jesus. It is utterly irrational. It is utterly blind. It is utterly without any warrant or evidence or anything like that. But when you catch them speaking most honestly, and I just had my jaw drop talking to some Jews on some occasions, you know, everything about their worldview seems to be the same as mine. And you say, so why don't you believe in Jesus? And their response is, well, because then I couldn't be a Jew. Which is utterly nonsensical. Of course you could be a Jew. Jesus was a Jew. But in their minds, there's this irrational, deep-seated prejudice that by definition, if you start believing Jesus, you have forsaken your Judaism. And so not wanting to do that, and that could be out of very godly motives, to not forsake their Judaism, they have it in their mind that they just can't believe in Jesus. And what is their picture of Jesus? Hitler, I mean, all kinds of connotations and images and associations that go with that for them that just makes it totally implausible. Well, what's going to happen when all that gets cleared up for them? When they're confronted with the reality of who Jesus is? Well, then everything, if I'm right, everything about their heart and their spirit and their goals and their desires is going to recognize this is what Moses was talking about. This is the other prophet in the likeness of Moses that was to come, and they will respond. But they may not be there today, and yet spiritually be on the right track.
Well, they might come from, true Christians might come from all over. I mean, would you point them anywhere else except?
No, absolutely not. No. Because this is the truth.
Yeah.
So, yeah, good question. I mean, I'm not in any way at all saying, look, you can get there in any religion, so just pick whichever one you want. No, of course not. This is the truth. Yeah. Michael?
On the point about getting to Christ through various religions, well, I pulled one analogy that kind of says it's kind of like several blind people feeling an elephant on various poles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but Christianity would see the elephant as a whole. The last quote is kind of my own kind of interpretation of what it would mean.
Mm-hmm.
On the quote of various things, many of them do have some quotes right. I've also noticed that on other quotes, they are in complete contradiction to Christianity.
Right, right.
So, like Islam, even though it mentions Jesus, denies first that he's the Son of God, and also says that Muhammad is greater than Jesus.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Back to the elephant analogy. Usually, I've heard that elephant analogy used in the context of the sort of thing that Ryan was talking about, that always lead to truth, and so it really doesn't make any difference. And it wouldn't have to be used in that way. But if what we mean is that within the context of different religions may have captured some things about the truth about objective reality, then I think that's fair. I mean, I think that's valid. I wouldn't go so far, Michael, to say that. I mean, okay. I think the Bible captures the whole elephant. I don't think I, as a Christian, do.
No. Well, I wasn't saying that any individual.
Okay.
Does.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just saying that Christianity does.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. I think that's right.
What, if anything, is known about the man during the crucifixion that accepted Christ?
On the cross, right. with Jesus.
As far as I know, which is very little is known about him.
Right.
And other than that, he deserved to die.
Right.
And so it'd be interesting, at least from what you're talking about, to speculate, at least, was he one of the, even though he was a criminal, was he like a follower? Did he even know what was going on? Did he even have a clue what was happening in his current time? Or did he know about the movement of Jesus' followers? Any number of things, because it seems to be so stark, and that nothing was mentioned about him, that other than that he deserved to die, but yet he then went to glory because he saw what Christ was.
If you were to ask me for proof of this, I'm so rusty that I couldn't, but I just have a memory of having done a little bit of research about that. And the conclusion I reached was what seems most probable historically is that he was a political insurrectionist, probably a zealot, maybe even a Sicari. That there were two branches of Judaism that were very, very politically activistic, even militant. One were the zealots, and the other were the Sicari. The Sicari were a branch of the zealots where they're called that. Sicari means dagger. And they would hide a dagger in their cloak, walk through the marketplace, and literally assassinate either a Jew who was being complicit with the Roman rule, or if they could get to him, even a Roman ruler. And then they'd disappear in the crowd, and they were notorious for their assassinations. There were Sicarii, and then there were the Zealots. The Zealots were ready to foment armed revolt against Rome, and occasionally it actually resulted in armed revolt. Pilate himself put down several uprisings, and he was brutal in whenever. I mean, if he put down an uprising, he'd likely have hundreds of people crucified of the zealots that they captured. So, in all likelihood, Judas and the other two that were being crucified with I don't mean Judas, Barabbas, and the other two that were being crucified with Jesus were likely zealots of some kind, insurrectionists of some kind that were being crucified. Were they aware of Jesus? I think probably. I mean, I'm not sure that anyone was unaware of Jesus in those days. How much credence they gave him or how much attention they paid, I don't think we have any way of knowing. Did that get at the heart of your question, or?
Well, I just didn't. Is it mentioned that they were Jews?
Well, let's see. I don't know that it's ever explicitly mentioned, but I think it's highly likely that they were. I mean, if I'm right that they're zealots, then absolutely they were Jews.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So what were the key components of biblical philosophy then that that person on the cross acknowledged at the last second?
I mean, well,
you say belief in key components is an essential prerequisite. So what were the things that he came to acknowledge, I guess, at the last?
Notice that he noticed that what he acknowledged, while his friend was mocking Jesus, he told him, "Shut up! Don't you recognize? Don't you see what's happening here?" I mean, he basically, in view of the evidence before his very eyes, was willing to acknowledge the truth of what was going on here, that this was no ordinary human being. In fact, this man was innocent. We are guilty. We deserve to die. That's one thing. But this man is an innocent man who is voluntarily giving up his life.
So it wasn't necessarily that he believed that Jesus was God, or...
Right. I think that's highly unlikely. But I think he does... doesn't he actually use the language, "This is the Son of God"? I believe...
No, that was the term.
Oh, okay. I might be confusing those two. Yeah, we'd have to go to the account. Maybe somebody can check that out. But at the most, he would have acknowledged his messiahship, that this really is the Messiah.
In the time that Paul lived, and you had Paul who came against people who believed other than he preached about the gospel and things like that, and it just seems like there's, at one level, something very profound about what you do confess about the truth. That sort of, I mean, how, mm-hmm. what other way can you mark out someone who is truly speaking after truth? At the same time, there's like that element you say that person mm-hmm. could be in ignorance. I mean, Paul himself seems to make the claim that God showed him mercy. I think it might be in Galatians or somewhere where he says that because I was ignorant of the things of Jesus, God was, and he makes mention of the Jews who are zealous, you know, after these traditions of their ancestors, but not in knowledge. That is, they're not informed truly with knowledge. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to say exactly what he's condemnatory of them. I mean, I tend to see it as being kind of a condemnation of them. Sure, they're zealous, but they're zealous about they're ignorant and mm-hmm. not zealous after the right things.
Right.
I suppose it is possible that he's saying, well, they're zealous, and so maybe they're in, but they're just zealous about the wrong things. I mean, being a little softer, maybe.
No, I don't. No, I would agree with your first interpretation. I don't think he means that to commend them. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a sort of commendation in that, yeah, I'm glad you care about something. I mean, and that you care about God, but this is not enough.
Right.
That's not what.
And it seems hard to pinpoint exactly to what extent someone needs to be informed truly, you know, about something for them to then be responsible completely for it, or to show an animosity towards the whole truth just because they have animosity towards a part of it, you know, as they stand then, you know. And it seems like that's the hard thing to say, is like at the time of the Bible, you do see the biblical authors being, you know, standing up for something and saying, if you don't believe this, then you're just like, you know, you're lost, you know.
Yeah, but remember who are the biblical authors you're speaking to when they say that kind of thing.
No, that's true, right. I mean, there are these varying levels, for example,
right.
that, you know, if they were speaking to, you know, someone in, you know, Ethiopia,
exactly.
they wouldn't be like, I mean, I wouldn't think they would be as strong necessarily in the way that they approached that as they would be to Jews who would just see, you know,
yeah.
Jesus walk by. And
yeah,
I mean, you're talking to people who have this whole history, you know, of the prophets and of all these witnesses and of these signs and these miracles, and they're just totally resistant to the
exactly.
truth before them.
And that's the crucial thing, is that they're, you used the word earlier that I liked, but they're resistant to it. They're steeled against it. It's one thing, or animosity, they have an animosity toward it. The question is the unbelief rooted in a spiritual orientation of animosity toward God and truth, or is it a psycho-emotional block of some kind?
Or
ignorance. If it's ignorance, I mean, I think we can all pretty much agree that if it's ignorance, surely God does not condemn somebody because they accidentally didn't get the right information, right? So if it's out of ignorance, that that's not a damnable unbelief. This is more controversial, but I would argue that if it's out of some kind of psycho-emotional block of some kind that's beyond their control, that also is not a damnable unbelief. Damnable unbelief is unbelief that arises out of a spiritual orientation, an inward orientation, that indicates that the person doesn't want the truth to be the truth. They're not interested in that truth. They want all of reality to be a different reality than God has made it, and they're fighting for that. And if that means denying God, they'll deny God. If it means denying Jesus, they'll deny Jesus. And that's damnable unbelief. And I would argue that whenever the Bible talks about the unbelief that that makes a person accursed, it's talking about that kind of unbelief, an unbelief that's rooted in an inward spiritual hardness against God and the things of God.
And if there seems to be some, I mean, that's sometimes thrown together, though, with a historical ignorance, you know, of sorts, in terms of, because there are true things, for you can see in the Old Testament, for example, when Isaiah, he basically says to the nations, you know, you worship these wood, the stone, and you say they're gods, and yet you make them with your own hands, you know. Isn't this silly?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, aren't you being sort of ridiculous in that you're believing these are gods? And there's this sort of, I don't know, maybe tipping the hand to things which, even though, you know, these nations weren't necessarily have the benefit of the prophets like Israel did or other things, but there should have been something in them which said, this isn't right,
mm-hmm.
you know, and at this fundamental level, as you go up the hierarchy, sure, you know, Jesus isn't an issue, but the idea of, you know, who is God, you know, and is he wood and stone, is he things of this material world, or is he not? And on one level, it seems like a kind of a philosophical sort of a question, like, I mean, sort of, how would you really expect, you know, people to know whether or not God's one or many, or whatever he has to reveal himself? On the other hand, there does seem to be this sort of nod to this, I don't know what you call it, innate, or at least a nod to this kind of knowledge which people have from the organization of the world that would lead them to conclude, other than these nations have concluded about God.
Yeah, we'll talk more about that a little bit later, when it, how do we know this stuff is true.
Right.
But, right, I mean, just for now, from a biblical perspective, we are even willing to become irrational. We are even willing to believe silly, foolish things if by believing a silly, foolish thing, I don't have to bow my knee to God or Jesus or whatever. I mean, that, so it's that folly, that foolishness, that irrationality is one of the telltale signs of a spiritual problem inside, a hardness against the truth that refuses to go there.
But based on what you're saying now, that also can be sort of meshed together with people who are truly ignorant.
And right.
There's that sense in which, you know, these people are raised outside of Judaism. They're outside of that pale of people who do know that there is one God.
Yeah.
And then kind of keep our policies and nod that on Mars still in Acts 17, where he says, you know, before now God winked at your ignorance, but now, you know, behold, you know,
right.
His Christ and his purposes. And
exactly. Before we lose track of Chris's question, let me go to this passage here. This is in Luke 23. And the soldiers also mocked him, coming up to him, offering him sour wine, and saying, if you are the king of the Jews, there's his messiahship, save yourself. Now there was also an inscription above him, this is the king of the Jews. And one of the criminals who was hanged there was hurling abuse at him, saying, you are not the Christ, the Messiah. Save yourself and us. But the other answered and rebuking him said, do you not even fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? We indeed justly, for we are receiving what we deserve for our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong. And he was saying, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And he said to him, truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise.
So the
conversation surrounding the event, thank you, was his messiahship, but it's his innocence that he makes explicit.
Right. Mm-hmm. So is it the is it his belief that Christ is the Messiah
that in effect gets them into heaven?
Well, see, I don't think so, because that's what I'm arguing, is that I think we make a mistake to think that it's the act of believing that is meeting the condition we must meet. I think the condition we must meet is to have an inwardness, an openness of heart, to see the truth when we're confronted with it, to see and to bow our knee to the truth when we're confronted with it. Well, what was he confronted with? The reality that Jesus was innocent, and that, so what he does is he extrapolates, what must it be that Enoch believed in order that God was pleased with him? Well, he must have believed that God is, and that he's a rewarder of those who seek him. Well, that's pretty minimal, you know. On the one hand, it seems... in our way of thinking, it's, you know, we think, well, that's cheating. I have to believe so much more. That's not fair. But do we realize how hard it is to believe that God is, and that he's a rewarder of those who seek him? That's our problem. That's the problem of every human being on the planet, is that we don't believe that. So the rest of the stuff is easy once I get past that. Jesus makes sense. If I come to believe that God is, and that he's a rewarder of those who seek him, and I have to add one other thing there, and that I'm unworthy. But once I get those three pieces in, Jesus is a piece of cake. Michael?
I'm a quote about innocent versus diabolical mistakes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, what you refer to as an innocent mistake would be like not believing because you have not been exposed to Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And a diabolical mistake would be like, you know what the Pharisees made despite the overwhelming evidence of Jesus, they still refused to believe.
Yeah.
You know, like this particular scene, I think it somewhere like it might be John. I'm not 100% sure, but it might be an evil, a 7, 8, 10, or 11, one of those. I know it's not. I really forget, but it's somewhere in John where Jesus is doing his teaching. You see, what happens is, a blind man comes up to him, and apparently it's a tradition that if someone's born blind, which this man was, mm-hmm. it was because he will heal his parents' sins.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jesus heals him.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the Pharisees find out, they start asking questions, and they've been throwing anyone out of a synagogue who confesses that Jesus is Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they ask the man who was healed, he says that if this man was not from God, he could do nothing. Yeah, and then the Pharisees do indeed pull him out, and at the whole end, Jesus says, I have come into this world so that blind may see, And then the Pharisee says, what are we blind to?
Mm-hmm.
And then Jesus concludes with saying, if you were blind, you would not be guilty, but now that you can see, your guilt remains.
Yes.
Would that last part be considered a diabolical mistake on their part?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Where the underlying problem is a spiritual unwillingness, an animosity, a hostility, a hardness, a blindness, a spiritual blindness to acknowledge the truth is truth. You and I, as we read our Bibles, we get a bunch of stuff wrong. I know that I don't have everything about what the Bible is teaching me right, but I hope it's the case that it's not because I am unwilling to allow the truth to be truth. I just am getting it wrong. Well, that's what I'm calling an innocent mistake. And what I mean by innocent is it's not ultimately the result of my hardness against God and truth itself. I just don't get, just didn't get it right. But there are whole classes of people in this world who don't get it right because they don't want to get it right. Because getting it right places some demands on them that they are unwilling to respond to. John?
It seems like there's this interplay between seeing and, on the one hand, not being able to see something that's true. On the other hand, seeing that it's true and rejecting that, like this, almost rejecting the gift in a certain sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but being so resilient to the follow through that would entail seeing the truth for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things another thing that I like is your hymn has a kind of transcultural element that, I mean, it kind of takes care of some of the things that we find so irrational about, condemning 6 billion Chinese or whatever.
Right.
There's so many strikes. It's so wrong about that. So I like your account. It takes care of that, but it also takes care of the fact that over half America is Christian.
Right.
So it's something that not only is relevant to non-believers, but also relevant to believers.
Explain that.
So it's also relevant to cultural Christians.
Because
on the one hand, they could affirm explicitly Jesus Christ as our Savior, yet what you're saying is that there's an internal.
Exactly.
And so it's not. I mean, so that solves the other problem that if what matters is explicit belief, well then, right. I mean, we have a different set of problems that
right.
this takes care of.
Right.
One question that I have within cultural Christianity is that I was wondering if you could talk about where fear comes into play with an openness to truth. Particularly, sometimes it goes Pascal's wager, right? You know, it's either burn in hell or nothing happens. So I might as well offer the thing that won't let me burn in hell because it doesn't. The other one, oh well, I got it wrong.
Right.
Could you talk about any kind of openness to truth be manifest there? I mean, I suppose it's dangerous to go out on your own, you know, to stand against what other people are saying is true and the condemnation that comes with that sometimes. Like, I seriously watch this at an underclub sometimes. I'm like, you know, hell, I'm just going to become a fundamentalist because this is scary. And I'm not even a part of that culture.
Right.
So, I suppose the openness that you're saying.
I don't think you'd make it.
So the openness you're talking about is a kind of, on the one hand, a kind of rational openness, but I'm wondering what basically addresses the phenomenon of fear and doing things because you're afraid of.
Okay.
I mean, rather than a rational process.
Okay. There may be several aspects to your question that I may not be picking up on the right ones, but. Take Pascal's wager. One of the problems with Pascal's wager is that this openness that makes us children of God is an openness to the truth about God and reality, and an openness to embrace that. Well, the language that the Bible ultimately uses there is knowing God and loving God. Fearing God, yes, but I think it's fearing God in a different sense than what we're talking about here. It's to love God and to know God. To calculate that to cover my risks, I guess I'll go ahead and believe in God or believe that Christianity is true so I don't have to go to hell. The problem is, you go to hell anyway. I mean, believing in God in that way is not the right kind of belief that makes you not go to hell. Do you see what I'm saying? Because it's a real... It's not protecting myself in a calculated risk. That kind of, yes, you can come to an explicit expression of faith that way, but you can't make yourself transformed inside into the kind of person who's really, let me change the word, who's tender, who's
full of passionate pursuit and not just offer fire insurance.
Right, yeah. Who's willing to be infinitely committed to the infinite, for example. I mean, you don't get there out of a Pascal's wager.
So what you're presenting tonight is really, really is an affirmation of, calling us to embrace what it means to be a thinking, existential agent, and that means recognizing our limitations. Like, when something hasn't clicked, it hasn't clicked.
Right. Right.
Because hellfire and brimstone is turning over it, that doesn't give us the warrant for that sort of belief.
Right.
So in a certain way, what you're presenting is really radical in the sense that, you could be presented with the truth, but if you haven't become proportionate to that truth, and what I mean by that is, like, you don't understand the language, you don't understand the conceptual, then maybe it's okay for a person to take their time.
Exactly. Exactly.
And you don't have to worry about them getting caught.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I don't think we'll go to the judgment seat and God is going to say, "Oh, sorry, I got to send you to hell. You weren't done yet." I just don't think that's going to happen.
I have a question. You're not saying that one excludes the other here, though. I mean, you can still have an actual explicit belief and have an inner openness.
Oh, absolutely. That's the ideal. I mean, and in fact, someone may raise the question, well, why bother to read the Bible and understand what the truths are if I can be a child of God without knowing these things? Well, fair enough. But as creatures, part of life itself in the kingdom of God and part of life here and now is, that part Aristotle got right. We are rational creatures. We were made to have my rationality satisfied. So one of the things that's so delightful about coming into the kingdom of God is having a clue. I know, I get it. I understand what this is all about. Wisdom, knowledge. I mean, it's astounding how many times Paul talks about wisdom and knowledge in the context of Jesus. Because that in and of itself is its own reward as well. So even if I were utterly convinced that I don't need to understand anything at all about the Bible in order to be saved, I'd still want to study the Bible because it's the truth. It's what tells me what it's all about. And I would argue that part of being a child of God, to love God is to love the truth as well. And so if I can be absolutely casual and cavalier and dismissive of the truth, it raises the question, well, then what do you think of God? I mean, can I be rightly related to God and hate the truth or have no regard for the truth? I don't think so. And that's why the Bible is so attractive to us who are being called out by God, because we're being called into the truth, and this is the beacon of truth, that it just draws us to it.
That passage says that you're being saved unto good works. In other words, it's not just being a child of God and being open to the truth,
right,
but it's the actual being called into the truth and the practice of the truth,
exactly,
which is truly fulfilling. I mean, it's one thing to be open to the truth, it's another thing to actually come up to hold that truth and then to see how that truth acts it out in love towards other people.
Right, exactly. John?
I don't know if you're going to get to this at some point down the road, but I guess I would like to try to figure out, what do you do with the capital T truth in a culture, and by culture I mean like the people that were at my dinner table, during Christmas. I mean, that's my culture. What do you do with the capital T truth in a culture that absolutely doesn't believe that there is an objective, as long as you're not killing anybody, c'est la vie.
Yeah.
I mean, how do I talk to my mother-in-law about capital T truth when she has no concept of it?
Well, I don't know if I have a good answer. That's an important challenge that we all face today. I think partly is we have to keep in mind, no, they do. They do believe in a capital T truth mostly, usually. It's just when it becomes convenient to pretend like they don't believe in that, they talk another story. They tell us another story. So part of it is recognizing that when I do explain to them this is the capital T truth, that's not going to be completely alien to them. Now, I still have my work cut out for me because they're going to resist that. I mean, and they have all kinds of cultural reinforcement. But I don't know what else to do other than say, no, you're not thinking about this right. I'm not saying this is my religion. I'm saying this is the truth. And just insist on that. And I think that's got to be comprehensible even to people in our culture, even though they're going to fight it like crazy.
And then the second thing I have, and you may get to it in the innocent versus diabolical thing, how does that fit into God's sovereignty? In a sense, I'm thinking the mistakes that I make, I'm going to be held accountable for, but I'm at, in another sense, I'm at where I'm at because God's writing in that way.
Right, you know? Right.
So does it matter whether it's an innocent or a diabolical? You know what I'm saying?
Well, just because God may ultimately be the source of both doesn't mean that there's not an important qualitative difference between the two. One is damnable, the other is not. For the one, God is just and right to condemn me. For the other, if he condemned me for it, I think it would be just unjust. So there really is a qualitative difference between what's going on there. Amy, it's your...
Just have a real quick question. How does all this play into predestination?
Well, can we save that until we get to...
I don't really mean that.
Okay. Okay.
If God is an author, if he is trying to make an explicit point, but with this, and I'm just not grasping fully, I think I'm not saying this what you're saying, but with this, it seems like his language or his point is kind of great and fuzzy. Because if it's not explicitly Christ or explicitly a certain language, then what are we looking for? Or what is his explicit point? Because it seems harder for me now to grasp what the point is.
Well, no, I'm sorry. I've confused you. No, his point is explicitly and centrally and only and purely Christ. Mm-hmm. Christ is the one for whom the whole world was made. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't get more fundamental and central to everything God is doing than Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Okay? And that there's nothing fuzzy about that point. There's no ambiguity there. That's just the truth.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to blur... I'm not trying to blur the truth about Jesus. I'm asking a different question. How clearly do I have to see that, however, as clear as that point of God's is, how clearly do I have to see it in order to be saved, in order to qualify as a child of God? And that's where I'm saying, well, that's a different question. You know, regardless of how Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and no man comes to the Father but by him, as insistent as he can be on that, although that's true, how clear do I have to be in my own mind and experience that is true in order for me to be rightly related to God? And that's why I'm saying I don't think the Bible looks at that the same way modern Christian culture does. We turn it into doctrine.
Yeah.
And don't look at the heart.
Well, when you say Christ and that truth, are you saying the guy on the cross? Like, do they have to kind of be confronted with that? Or is Christ much bigger than that guy on the cross? Is it a much deeper truth than that? And they have something much deeper going on spiritually. They didn't get confronted with that guy on the cross thing, but
a much... Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Maybe I misunderstood your original point. Because Enoch did not believe in Jesus or anybody dying on a cross. Enoch just believed that God was and that he was a rewarder of those who sought him. And having that kind of heart for God, there's a lot he didn't know, but what he did know manifest the heart of somebody with a heart after God. and God rewarded him. So, no, I don't. I mean, there are a lot of people who hold the doctrine that other people in other religions, if they have a heart that's open to God, God will see to it that Jesus somehow supernaturally visits them and confronts them with himself so that they will believe in him. Now, why are they saying that? The reason they're saying that is because the underlying assumption that they're making is it's the act of believing in Jesus that saves you. And if it's the act and only the act of believing in Jesus that saves you, they couldn't be saved if Jesus didn't go to them, confront them, and elicit from them the act of believing in him. Well, that's reasonable. I mean, I understand why they take that position. I understand. And in a way, it's a very... the intuition behind their belief is the same thing that I'm advocating here, that God is bigger than our... than the limitations of our knowledge and experience, and that's what they're trying to find an answer to. But they're trying to find an answer to that and still preserve the assumption that it's the act of believing in Jesus and only that that saves you. That's what I'm challenging. And I'm saying, well, it's the act of believing in Jesus that is going to be the act that every true child of God who is going to be saved will one day perform. Yes, we will all perform that act one day. But is it that act in and of itself that saves us? Or do we commit that act because we're the kind of person that God is saving? I think it's the latter. And so in the chronology of what happens first, in the sequence of what happens first, it's no problem to God that he saves us because we have the right kind of heart, because we are children of God, and we don't get around to bowing our knee to Jesus until later. That's not a problem for God.
So would you say there's kind of two realities kind of going on simultaneously? One of them is the universal reality of being a child of God needs to be one who seeks after truth and righteousness and godliness. And no matter where you are in the historical time frame, you know, that's always going to be true.
Right.
How it manifests itself in terms of its historical content is filled out by how God is running history. That is, what is the point of history? Well, it's about the Son that he has brought into the world, who is his unique Son, and who is going to be the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And if you're going to be in his kingdom and you're going to be a child of God, he's going to be your king.
Yeah.
And so it's that particular truth and this reality that we, as people who are children of God, who are pursuing righteousness and holiness and all those other things, that's the truth we come to in the end if we're truly his.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's, Jesus is the point because he is the figurehead of this history. But at the same time, in our own individual historical lives, our seeing that clearly will depend upon where we are in history, and people who are way back in history before Jesus was born obviously don't have access to that knowledge. But what they do have is that universal reality that they are God's children, and therefore in the age to come will come to an understanding of who Jesus is as the King.
Exactly.
I'm wondering about the implications this has for evangelism. And what I mean by that, particularly by affirming, by placing the emphasis less on explicit beliefs, but rather putting the emphasis on the openness of the believer towards truth, you're recognizing the dynamic process. That, and for instance, if you were to hop in a time machine and go back to Jack when you were 18 and go, this isn't true, you might have disagreed with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. I know I would have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, so, but you're still the same Jack. And what the thing that's the same now as then is your openness to the truth.
Yeah, well said.
If that's the case, then it seems like evangelism takes a certain, maybe means taking a certain skill of finding out how proportionate one is to the truth. So if one doesn't even have give a rip about truth, or if someone has certain cultural biases or intellectual biases, those might have to be tackled. Before one can present them with
yeah.
truth.
No, I think that's exactly right. I've had some conversations with non-believers in recent years where that was strikingly the case, that when I finally got to the heart of what they thought it meant to believe in Jesus, the only conclusion I could come to it would be evil to believe in Jesus, if that's who Jesus is. I mean, it's just because they have such a distorted, warped, pervert, because of their experience. I mean, their experience has given the content to them of who Jesus is and what he's all about, and it's completely contrary to everything in the Bible. So my the tack that I took with them was not to try to push them to believe in Jesus, but was to approach it, as you say, in more their relationship with God, their relationship with truth, their relationship with righteousness and stuff like that, as I tried to re-educate them about who Jesus was. And I found them interestingly open to that in a way that, I mean, I hit a brick wall immediately if I brought Jesus into the picture because of what it meant to them.
So I think it's a good job of accounting for the allergy I have to tracks.
Uh-huh.
Is that you really, I mean, there's something that strikes me as silly. I get so frustrated, and I've never been able to really put my finger on it, but it's that the total dismissal of the dynamic character of human knowing, especially in this sinful world, which means that you have to go through conversion after conversion after conversion, intellectually, morally, spiritually, before you can get to a place that you can
see the truth. Yeah, I think you're right.
So that means there's not going to be an altar call.
I didn't say that.
One way to put kind of what you're talking about, this belief, one way to say it is I'm someone who has reached a point of just saying, oh, I'm so thankful God gave me the gift of believing, because I, this is something I just begin to recognize as a gift I could have that I'm able to begin to see, get beyond the, all kinds of stuff that makes me not interact with reality. But God has allowed me or given me this gift, this showing. Doing something, but I couldn't have even done it without God.
Right.
I mean, that's what you mean by the openness, and, or it starts with that.
Yes. I mean, where that openness comes from, I'll talk about that more later. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, I'm going to argue it is a gift from God. I believe that it's a supernatural miracle that any of us have that openness. But right now, I'm just trying to focus on what is it itself. Is it the actual act of explicitly saying, I believe in Jesus, or is it something more profound and more a part of who we are on the inside? And I think it's the latter. And that hasn't, and like Jonathan was saying earlier, I mean, one of the implications of this is that it explains why you can have people who explicitly believe in Jesus and who are utterly evil people. I mean, you know some of them. Some of the people who read the Bible the most are the most perverse people that I've met. I'm not saying that lightly. People who sexually abuse their children, people who are physically abusive, are involved in all kinds of perversions. And I don't know what the psychology of this is, but they spend the rest of their life reading their Bibles, and they know it inside out and backwards. Well, you know, don't tell me they're explicitly believing that Jesus has done anything in their life or means anything about their relationship with God. It's a completely empty reality for them.
And so, the idea that to please God, someone who explicitly believes, we need to rack up as many with our tracks, gather as many, and that's how we believe God.
I mean, there are dozens of religious spiritual games we can play in the name of Jesus. The Bible is not talking about any of those. it's talking about reality, not games. It's not these little psychological, emotional strategies that we use and security blankets that we create for ourselves and fictions and stories that we tell ourselves in the name of Jesus. This is talking about reality. And the reality is there's a God that we have to come to terms with, the God who's our creator that we have to come to terms with. And the story that he is authoring throughout cosmic history is centered in Jesus, and it's all about Jesus. I need to understand that, I need to come to terms with that, and I need to deal with that, and I need to choose accordingly. That's what the Bible is talking about. But we can invent all kinds of fictions that we attach the name of Jesus or Christianity or faith or whatever to, that have nothing to do with the reality of what God is doing in the world. And we have to be wise. We have to be discerning about the difference. It's not everyone who says the name of Jesus, proclaims the name of Jesus, who believes in him. Most of the people who proclaim the name of Jesus don't believe in him. We have to be savvy about that, I think.
Yeah.